The Roots of Obama's Rage by Dinesh D'Souza, continued, Disc 6. The financial crisis occurred when interest rates began to rise and housing prices began to fall. That's when people began to default on those loans and, in some cases, to stop making payments and walk away from the houses they had bought. Suddenly, the banks realized that this problem could be very widespread, and since no one knew what the default rate might turn out to be, no one knew what those mortgage-backed securities were really worth. Wall Street had been buying and selling the securities in the expectation of traditionally low default rates. When investment houses figured out that they were holding toxic assets that might be worth only a fraction of their list price, they began to sell those assets at fire sale prices. Investors with money parked at these investment houses feared losing their capital and demanded it back. A run on the investment houses ensued, and many found themselves facing liquidation and, in some cases, bankruptcy. This, then, was the panic that produced the Great Recession of 2008. But it was a recession, not a depression. Its speed caught everyone by surprise, but America had endured severe recessions before, most recently in 1981 to 1982. To this day, economists debate whether the financial sector faced a crisis of bankruptcy or merely a crisis of liquidity. Bankruptcy means that your liabilities outweigh your assets, you cannot meet your debts, and under ordinary circumstances, you should go out of business. A liquidity crisis means you have the assets, but you cannot convert them into cash right away. Now, behind the so-called mortgage-backed securities were real homes and real people, most of whom were making regular monthly mortgage payments. Sure, some of these people may end up defaulting on their loans, but they hadn't defaulted yet. The problem with the securities wasn't that they had little or no value, but that no one had a good idea of what their value was. Uncertainty, rather than bankruptcy, seemed to be the real problem. The federal government needed to restore liquidity throughout the financial system so that banks could make loans once again. But just as important, the government needed to revive business, consumer, and investor confidence in the economy. Obama's blasting of bankers and Wall Street executives could hardly be expected to restore business confidence. But even more revealing were Obama's policy remedies, which tell us a lot about his real economic objectives. First, the administration not only provided bailout funds for banks, but it also wrote the terms of those bailouts in such a way that the federal government would retain control over the banks. This is not to say that the government had no control before. Banks have always been federally regulated. But Obama has expanded federal power over the banking sector. One clue to Obama's intentions is that his administration insisted on bailing out not just banks that were failing, but also banks that were not. Some 300 banks were force-fed a federal infusion of $200 billion. The largest banks all got infusions of capital, whether they wanted them or not. Some banks, of course, desperately needed the money, but others did not. Yet it seems that Obama wanted to exercise federal leverage over those banks as well. Most of the banks have now repaid their bailouts, but in some cases the Obama administration has refused to permit large banks to make repayments. Now this is very strange. You might expect that the government would, on behalf of the taxpayer, welcome the idea of getting its money back. But if the government takes back the money, then it no longer has the same degree of control over that bank. So Obama has approved a stress test in which the government decides which banks are economically healthy enough to be allowed to pay their bailouts back. Normally, moneylenders don't need to do stress tests. If the guy is willing to pay his loan, it's safe to assume he is in a position to do so. But the stress test keeps the decision in the hands of the government, not the banks, no matter how eager the bank may be to escape the clutches of the government. Now, one might assume that a financially healthy bank that has passed Obama's stress test should be able to repay its bailout. Not so, according to Obama's Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. Geithner told the Wall Street Journal that the health of individual banks isn't enough to qualify them to repay the government. "We want to make sure that the financial system is not just stable, but also not inducing a deeper contraction in economic activity. We want to have enough capital that it's going to be able to support a recovery." In essence, the banks have to wait until the Obama administration decides that it's in the national interest for them to repay. Second, the Obama administration diverted bailout money to rescue two of the big three Detroit auto companies, General Motors and Chrysler. Now, as an economic solution, Obama's actions were both unwise and unnecessary. The auto companies have been mismanaged for decades, partly because of the ineptitude of the bosses, partly because of the millstone effect of the auto unions. In an attempt to extract as much as possible from management, the unions have raised the cost of making cars so high that Detroit is no longer competitive. Japanese companies can make better cars in American plants for a cheaper price. Detroit is going under because it deserves to go under. Sure, a bailout can postpone the day of reckoning in the faint hope that Detroit will get its act together, but only an investor who is using other people's money would be so careless as to take this kind of a chance. No sooner did the Obama administration approve the General Motors bailout than Obama ordered the firing of General Motors Chairman Rick Wagoner. Certainly, Wagoner was an inept executive who deserved to go. But by this standard, all the major Detroit auto executives deserve to go. To get an idea of what buffoons these people are, when Congress asked them to testify about their dire financial straits, they all traveled to Washington, D.C. in private jets. Congressmen had a great time castigating them for that in front of the TV cameras. So Wagoner was just one poor performer in a circus of poor performers. His ousting may have been overdue, but it is not usually the role of United States presidents to fire inept CEOs of big corporations. Obama was using the occasion to show who's in charge. In the case of GM and Chrysler, the Obama administration renegotiated the terms of creditor contracts so that the union pension plans would get preferential treatment and Chrysler's investors would move to the back of the line. For Obama, the recovery of GM and Chrysler seemed less important than figuring out how the spoils would be carved up. No one should have been surprised by Obama's behavior. As he wrote in The Audacity of Hope, "I owe those unions. When their leaders call, I do my best to call them back right away. I got into politics to fight for these folks." To put Obama's comments in their appropriate context, think of Chrysler's investors as part of the profit-seeking neo-colonial overclass, and think of the unions as the struggling, lowly resistors who are fighting against that overclass. Now you can see why empowering the unions and weakening the claims of the investors took priority for Obama over everything else. Whether Chrysler can actually avoid future bankruptcy or whether taxpayer money is being wisely spent, none of this seemed to matter. A very different battle was being fought, and Obama got the outcome he wanted. A third measure taken by Obama to respond to the financial crisis was to sign into law a bill containing the most sweeping regulations of Wall Street since the 1930s. Working with Senator Chris Dodd and Representative Barney Frank, the Obama administration secured congressional support for a series of measures that would transfer power from the financial sector to the federal government. For instance, the government would now have new authority to oversee financial firms, hedge funds, insurance companies, and even car dealers. The Obama administration can now monitor these companies, alter their capital requirements, and even shut them down and restructure them if they are deemed to be in danger of insolvency. Now, with Wall Street, as with the car companies, the issue is not whether some form of government intervention was necessary. In this case, I think it was necessary. But the objectives of reducing Wall Street's go-go financing schemes could be more easily met by reestablishing something like the old banking and lending requirements. If banks have loans that are federally guaranteed, then they must have a stated level of reserves to back up those loans. Mortgages should have a specified down payment or at least a specified level of risk. And that's it. But once again, Obama's objectives appeared to have more to do with castigating the financial industry. The American people will never again be asked to foot the bill for Wall Street's mistakes. And bringing the financial sector under federal control than any kind of genuine reform. Reform for Obama means, from now on, I tell you what to do. Obama's final strategy to combat the financial crisis was to open up the federal money faucet in an attempt to produce stimulus and create jobs. But how does the federal government stimulate an economy? And how does it create a job? Let's take the job question first. Sure, the government can create jobs by, say, doubling the number of people who work at the post office or by hiring more bureaucrats in this or that agency. But how does a government create jobs in the private sector? There is only one way, by providing incentives for entrepreneurs to hire more people. The best way to do this is to reduce corporate tax rates or capital gains taxes. Neither of these options was even considered by the Obama administration. In fact, Obama has proposed raising the capital gains tax from 15 to 28%. Obama's stimulus package started at around $800 billion and will end up costing the taxpayer something close to $1 trillion. Obama insisted that the government spending this kind of money would get the economy going again. According to the Department of Labor, unemployment was at 7.7% in January 2009, when Obama took office. And now it is 9.5%. Some stimulus. If you want to know why such programs usually don't work, ask yourself this question. From where does the government get the funds to stimulate? The answer, of course, is from the private sector. In some form or other, the government has to take money from taxpayers in order to spend that money itself. Now imagine that you take $100 from me and spend it. How have you stimulated anything? Sure, you have more cash to spend than you did before, but now I have less cash to spend than I did before. So when the federal government uses taxpayer funds to repair roads or fund artists or build unnecessary airports in the districts of influential congressmen, the government is taking away money that could have been used for other things, such as starting new businesses, making new products, and hiring new employees. In sum, the stimulus was less a boost to the overall economy than a transfer of spending power from the private sector to the federal government. Once again, it was an issue of control, and once again, Obama came out a winner. In this case, however, the full measure of Obama's victory is yet to be appreciated. Not only did Obama increase the power of the federal government through stimulus, he also got his chance to stick it to the fat cats. Sticking it to the fat cats is an important part of the anti-colonial program. And Obama made it clear from the outset that this group, the group he calls the rich, would pay for the whole thing. No tax increases on the ordinary American or the middle class. The entire bill, Obama promised, would be delivered to those Americans who make $250,000 a year or more. The overclass that, in Obama's words, is not paying their fair share. It's worth asking for a moment, what is meant by this term, fair share? What is fair for rich people to pay? Obama never addresses this question. But now, consider the fact that under today's tax structure, a person who is earning $1 million a year pays around $375,000 in federal taxes. That's not counting a whole raft of other taxes that typically raises the tab to around $450,000. That means if you make $1 million, you only keep around $550,000. The government basically takes $450,000 off the top. Aren't you already paying your fair share? According to Obama, you are not. Now, consider how much revenue the federal government currently gets from the rich. According to government data, the top 1% of income earners in the country pays about 40% of all the income tax revenues. The next 9% of income earners pays another 30%. So the top 10% of income earners pays more than 70% of all the taxes. As for the bottom 40% of income earners, they pay nothing. Now, I don't know about you, but to my way of thinking, this is an unfair system. It is unfair to the rich. First of all, I believe that everyone except the truly poor should pay some taxes. If we believe in no taxation without representation, then we should also believe in no representation without taxation. In a democratic society, it is good for citizens to have at least some stake in the system. Moreover, we can all agree that the rich should pay more, but I think they should pay proportionately more.